A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been chewing on something that sits right at the intersection of science and, well, everything else. The word sustainability gets thrown around so much it's practically lost its edges, but he wants to know what it actually means as a planetary operating manual. Three questions, essentially. What are the non-negotiable parameters that define a viable Earth system? How tight is the envelope we're supposed to stay inside? And why have we been failing at this for basically the entire time we've been measuring it?
That third question is the one that keeps me up. Not what are the boundaries, we've mapped those, but why knowing them hasn't changed the trajectory.
Right. It's like having a speedometer and an empty fuel gauge and still pressing the accelerator. So the framework that answers Daniel's first two questions is the planetary boundaries work out of the Stockholm Resilience Center. And it's not just an academic exercise. It's the closest thing we have to a diagnostic dashboard for whether the planet is still functioning as the planet we evolved in.
And the dashboard is flashing red. 6 of the 9 dials are in the danger zone as of the 2023 update. That's up from 4 in 2015. The safe operating space is shrinking while we're still mapping it.
So what does it actually mean to define the operating parameters of a planet? Because sustainability in this context isn't a political stance. It's a dynamical system's property. A sustainable system maintains its function over time, without trending toward depletion or needing external intervention. That's it. No reusable tote bags required.
And the Planetary Boundaries Framework, first proposed by Rockström and others in 2009, updated by Stefan and others in 2015, and again in 2023, tries to put numbers on that. 9 Earth system processes, each with a quantified safe operating space. The idea is that for the last 10,000 years, the Holocene, these 9 parameters stayed within a fairly narrow range, and that stability is what allowed human civilization to develop. Agriculture, cities, all of it. The Holocene was the sweet spot.
So the boundaries aren't arbitrary thresholds someone pulled out of thin air. They're the Holocene envelope. The conditions we know work because they're the conditions we've always known.
Right. And crossing a boundary doesn't mean you fall off a cliff the next day. It means you've left the Holocene range and entered a zone of increasing risk, where feedback loops can push the system into a new state that may not support the same kind of civilization. The key word is non-linear change. The system doesn't degrade smoothly, it lurches.
Let's walk through the dashboard. 9 dials. What are we measuring?
I'll group them by status, because that tells the story. Already transgressed, meaning we're outside the safe zone. Climate change, biosphere integrity, land system change, biogeochemical flows, freshwater change, and novel entities. Approaching the threshold, ocean acidification and atmospheric aerosol loading. And then the one success story, stratospheric ozone depletion, which is recovering thanks to the Montreal Protocol.
1 out of 9. That's a batting average that gets you sent back to the miners.
The miners being extinction.
I was going for a sports metaphor, but sure, that works too. Walk me through the 2 Stefan identified as the core boundaries, the ones that drive everything else.
Climate change and biosphere integrity. These are the system level controls. If you cross these, the pressure amplifies on every other boundary through cascading feedbacks. Climate change is the one everyone knows. Atmospheric carbon dioxide concentration, currently around 420 parts per million. The boundary is set at 350. We crossed it in the late 80s.
And biosphere integrity. That's the one most people don't think about until someone mentions insects.
It's measured 2 ways. Genetic diversity, the extinction rate, and functional diversity, which is harder to quantify but measures whether ecosystems can still do what they do. The extinction rate boundary is set at 10 extinctions per million species per year. The background rate is roughly 1. We're currently at somewhere between 100 and 1,000 times the background rate. The boundary isn't just crossed, it's in the rearview mirror.
1,000 times the background extinction rate.
The range is wide because we don't have perfect counts, but the lower bound alone is catastrophic. And here's the thing about biosphere integrity. It's not just about saving the pandas. Biodiversity is the planet's immune system. It's what allows ecosystems to absorb shocks and keep functioning. You lose that redundancy, and a drought that would have been survivable becomes a collapse.
So climate and biosphere are the two that, if you lose them, the other seven don't matter because the cascades take everything with them.
That's the Stefan argument, and I think it holds up. But I want to spend time on the one I find most disturbing, because it gets the least attention. Biogeochemical flows, specifically nitrogen and phosphorus.
The fertilizer boundaries.
The Haber-Bosch process. Here's the number that should stop you cold. Human activity now fixes more reactive nitrogen than all natural processes combined. The boundary is set at 62 million tons per year. Current human fixation is about 150 million tons per year. We're at 2.5 times the safe limit.
Say that again. More reactive nitrogen than every natural process on Earth combined.
Natural terrestrial fixation. Lightning, soil bacteria, legumes doing their thing. That's about 58 million tons per year. The Haber-Bosch process alone fixes roughly 120 million tons. Add in cultivation of nitrogen-fixing crops and fossil fuel combustion, and you're at around 150. The boundary is 62. The math isn't subtle.
And this is the process that makes modern agriculture possible.
It's the reason roughly half the world's population is alive. Fritz Haber and Karl Bosch figured out how to pull nitrogen from the air and turn it into ammonia in 1909. Before that, the only way to get reactive nitrogen at scale was wait for lightning or mine bird guano. The Haber-Bosch process removed the nitrogen bottleneck on agriculture. It's arguably the most consequential invention of the 20th century.
And no, it's the one pushing us furthest past a planetary boundary.
The excess nitrogen doesn't stay on the fields. It runs off into rivers, into coastal waters, creates dead zones. The Gulf of Mexico dead zone is the size of Connecticut some years. It volatilizes into nitrous oxide, which is a greenhouse gas 300 times more potent than carbon dioxide. It acidifies soils. It disrupts entire nitrogen cycles that ecosystems spent millions of years calibrating.
Connecticut catching strays. Herman, you're from Storrs.
I'm aware of the comparison, yes. The dead zone is actually larger than Connecticut most years. I was being restrained.
The phosphorus side of this is equally grim. Phosphate rock is finite. We mine it, apply it, it runs off, and unlike nitrogen, there's no atmospheric reservoir to draw from. Once it's in the ocean, it's essentially gone on human timescales.
And the phosphorus boundary is also transgressed. Regional boundaries, not global. Phosphorus doesn't mix in the atmosphere the way nitrogen does, but the disruption to freshwater systems is severe. Algal blooms, eutrophication, fisheries collapse. The whole cascade.
The 2023 update added something new, freshwater change, and it split the boundary into blue water and green water.
This is a big deal. Blue water is what you'd think, rivers, lakes, groundwater, the stuff you can see and pump. Green water is soil moisture, the water the plants actually use. It's the water that makes rain-fed agriculture possible, and until recently, it wasn't part of the boundaries framework at all.
And both are now transgressed.
Both. The green water boundary is measured as root zone soil moisture deviation from Holocene conditions. We've altered it so dramatically through land use change, deforestation, and agriculture that large parts of the planet are now outside the Holocene range. The Amazon is a case study in this. The forest generates its own rainfall through evapotranspiration. Cut enough trees and the hydrological cycle breaks. The forest can't sustain itself even if you stop cutting.
Which brings us to the tipping point. Where are we on the Amazon?
The estimates put the tipping point at roughly 20 to 25% deforestation. Current deforestation is around 17%, so we're not at the threshold yet, but we're close enough that the combination of deforestation and climate change is already altering rainfall patterns in parts of the basin. The Southeast Amazon is already flipping from carbon sink to carbon source during dry seasons.
17%. So we've got somewhere between 3 and 8 percentage points of margin, and deforestation isn't stopping.
It's slowed under various administrations, it's accelerated under others, but the trend line isn't towards zero. And here's the hysteresis problem. Even if we stopped all deforestation tomorrow at 17%, the system might not return to its previous state. The moisture recycling infrastructure is already degraded. You can't just replant and rewind.
Hysteresis is the word I want to sit with for a minute, because it's the answer to Daniel's third question, why we've been failing at this. The lag between crossing a boundary and feeling the consequences is long enough that feedback comes too late for corrective action.
Ocean acidification is the clearest example. The ocean has absorbed about a quarter of the carbon dioxide we've emitted. That's buffered us from even worse warming. But the cost is that the ocean's pH is dropping. It's already down by about 0.1 pH units, which doesn't sound like much until you remember it's a logarithmic scale. That's about a 30% increase in acidity. And the effects on calcifying organisms, corals, shellfish, plankton, at the base of the food web, those effects are already measurable. But the full consequences won't land for decades. By the time the fisheries collapse, the carbon dioxide that caused it was emitted in the 1990s.
The system's inertia masks the damage until it's locked in. That's the structural failure. We're flying an aircraft where the controls respond on a 30-year delay.
And that brings us to the great acceleration. Stefan and others published a paper in 2015 that should be required reading for every human being. They plotted 24 indicators, 12 human activity indicators, 12 Earth system indicators, from 1750 to 2010. Population, GDP, water use, fertilizer consumption, paper production, transportation, telecommunications, foreign direct investment. Every single human activity indicator takes off like a rocket after 1950.
Post-war, the economic system built on the assumption of infinite resources and infinite waste absorption.
The graphs are almost comical. They're flat for 200 years, then they go vertical. The Earth system indicators, carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide, methane, tropical forest loss, ocean acidification, marine fish capture, they follow the same trajectory with a slight lag. The Great Acceleration is the period when humanity went from operating within Holocene boundaries to systematically overshooting them. And the pace hasn't slowed.
So the answer to why have we been failing isn't that we didn't know or didn't try. It's that the entire post-war economic order was constructed on a model that treats planetary boundaries as externalities. They're not in the accounting.
And when you try to put them in the accounting, you run into the justice dimension. The 2023 paper by Gupta and others on Earth, System Justice, makes this brutally clear. The boundaries are biophysical. They don't care about politics. But who caused the transgression and who bears the consequences are radically unequal. The global north has overshot most boundaries. The global south is being asked to constrain development within a safe operating space that's already been consumed by others.
You can't have what we had because we used up the budget isn't a message that lands well.
Nor should it. The nitrogen boundary is the starkest example. Sub-Saharan Africa uses a fraction of the nitrogen per hectare that Europe and North America use. Their soils are nitrogen depleted. They need more fertilizer to achieve food security. But the global nitrogen boundary is already at 2.5 times the safe limit. So who gets the remaining nitrogen budget? The answer, in practice, is whoever can pay for it.
And the Haber-Bosch trap tightens. The same process that enabled the population explosion is now one of the biggest threats to the system that sustains that population. There's no simple exit.
The ozone layer is the counterexample everyone reaches for, and it's instructive precisely because it shows why the other boundaries are harder. The Montreal Protocol worked. It phased out CFCs, the ozone layer is recovering, and it's projected to return to 1980 levels by around 2066 over the Antarctic. It's the one boundary that's moving in the right direction.
But the conditions that made Montreal work don't apply to climate or nitrogen.
The substitutes for CFCs existed and were affordable. The industry was concentrated. A handful of chemical companies, not every energy producer and farmer on Earth. The costs of compliance were manageable. And the problem was visible in a way that nitrogen runoff isn't. The ozone hole was a literal hole you could photograph from space. You can't photograph a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico in a way that has the same visceral impact.
The ozone hole was a wound. The nitrogen boundary is more like slow organ failure. You don't see it until the patient is on the table.
That's uncomfortably accurate. And the novel entity's boundary, plastics, synthetic chemicals, PFAS, microplastics, that one is even harder to visualize as a single problem. It's thousands of substances with different properties, different persistence times, different toxicities. The boundary is transgressed because we've introduced so many novel chemical entities into the environment that we can't even track them all, let alone assess their combined effects.
PFAS in rainwater everywhere on Earth. Microplastics in human placentas. That's not a boundary being approached. That's a boundary that's been obliterated.
The 2023 assessment essentially said, we can't quantify this one precisely, but we know we're past the safe zone. The precautionary principle applied retroactively.
So 6 of 9 boundaries transgressed. The safe operating space is shrinking. The feedback loops are too slow for course correction. And the one success story required conditions that don't replicate to any other boundary. This is the dashboard Daniel was asking about. It's not cheerful reading.
No, but it's also not prophecy. The boundaries framework is a diagnostic tool. It tells you what's wrong and how wrong it is. It doesn't tell you it's hopeless. It tells you where to apply pressure. The question is whether we have governance structures capable of responding to a diagnosis that requires coordinated action across every nation on Earth on timelines measured in decades.
The answer so far is, not really.
The Paris Agreement is the closest we've come on climate, and even that's a framework for voluntary commitments with no enforcement mechanism. There's no equivalent for nitrogen, no equivalent for biosphere integrity, no equivalent for novel entities beyond piecemeal chemical bans. We have a dashboard with no steering wheel.
The nitrogen one. I worked for a fertilizer company in the UK, early 2000s. Data analyst. I sat in sales meetings where they'd put up slides about feeding the world. Growing the future was the slogan. Had it on a pen.
Growing the future.
Still have the pen. Writes fine. Nobody ever mentioned the Gulf of Mexico. Not once. Not in 2 years of meetings. And we sold into the American market, so it's not like it wasn't relevant.
What was the scale of the operation?
Mid-size. Ammonium nitrate mostly. Supplied about 40 distributors across the Midwest. The sales team genuinely believed they were doing good work. They weren't villains. They'd talk about yields, about feeding a growing population, about how nitrogen was the difference between subsistence and surplus for farmers in developing countries. All of that's true.
Also, we're at 2.5 times the safe boundary.
That's the thing. You can't tell a clean story about this. Haber-Bosch feeds half the world. Take it away tomorrow and you get famine on a scale that makes everything else look like a rounding error. Keep using it at current rates and you get dead zones, nitrous oxide emissions, acidified soils, biodiversity collapse. There's no version where you're the good guy. You're just choosing which bad outcome to manage.
The trap. You called it the Haber-Bosch trap earlier, and that's exactly what it is. We built a civilization on a process that violates a planetary boundary, and now we can't unwind it without causing catastrophic harm to the people who depend on it.
The numbers get abstract fast. 150 million tons. 2.5 times the boundary. But I sat in a room with 12 people who all had families and mortgages, and they were trying to hit quarterly targets. That's the actual mechanism. 12 people in a room in Doncaster trying to move product. Multiply that by about 10,000, and you get the nitrogen boundary.
The slogan on the pen, growing the future. The process that enabled the population explosion is now one of the biggest threats to the system that sustains that population. The future they were growing is the one we're now trying to keep from collapsing.
The pen's in a drawer. I don't use it, but I haven't thrown it out either.
I understand that impulse.
The other thing nobody talks about is that the boundary number, 62 million tons, that's not some law of physics. It's a judgment about acceptable risk. The Holocene range for nitrogen fixation was probably between about 40 and 70 million tons. We set the boundary near the upper end. But the system doesn't care about our judgment. It cares about the actual flows. And the actual flows are 150.
Even the boundary is generous.
It's the edge of the Holocene envelope, the safe operating space, not the point of no return. We're past safe. We're not necessarily past irreversible. But we don't know where irreversible is, and the only way to find out is to keep going.
That's the hysteresis problem in a sentence. We don't know where the cliff is. We just know we've left the marked trail.
The company got bought in 2008. Private equity. They stripped the assets and closed the Doncaster plant. I was already gone by then. The pen's probably worth more than the company now.
The cutting room floor detail I keep coming back to is the Amazon moisture recycling numbers. A single tree in the Amazon releases about 1,000 liters of water into the atmosphere per day, through transpiration. The forest as a whole generates something like 20 billion tons of water vapor per day. That's more than the Amazon River discharges into the Atlantic. The forest is effectively a pump that pulls moisture from the Atlantic and cycles it inland. Cut enough trees and the pump fails. The whole system flips to savanna. And once it flips, the carbon released would be equivalent to about a decade of global emissions at current rates. That's not in the model yet. It's a risk multiplier on top of everything else.
The question Daniel's prompt leaves hanging is what sustainability even means as an operational goal at this point. If the safe operating space is shrinking, and the feedback loops are too slow, and the governance structures don't exist at planetary scale, are we managing decline or aiming for restoration? Those are different projects with different timelines and different ethical frameworks.
The boundaries framework gives us a dashboard, but a dashboard doesn't steer the car. We've never been better at measuring the system, and never was at staying within its limits. That's the tension. The data is clearer than it's ever been, and the trajectory hasn't bent.
The Haber-Bosch trap sits right at the center of it. The technology that sustains half the world's population is the same one pushing us furthest past a planetary boundary. There's no simple exit, no clean narrative, no hero arriving with a substitute that scales. Just a trap we built for ourselves because it solved a real problem, and now the solution is the problem.
Thanks to Hilbert Flemingtop for producing, and for the pen that's still in the drawer.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.